Today's episode of This Week I Learned is brought to you by the 400 horsepower Lincoln MKZ with a Revel audio sound system that gives you audiophile quality sound no matter where you sit in the vehicle. Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that worms can smell danger. They can also learn. These revelations come courtesy of a University of Iowa study that examined how one of the most abundant animals on Earth, the humble roundworm, reacts to stressful situations. In the study, one group of roundworms were exposed to the scent of a lethal bacterium. The other group weren't exposed to anything at all, but then both groups were exposed to the deadly bacterium itself. And the roundworms that were able to smell it first were more likely to survive. That's because the roundworms who had the scent exposure were able to prime a defense mechanism that protected the worm's cells and increased the cell's survival. So when they came into contact with the bacterium, the worms were able to draw up those defenses at a faster rate than the worms who had no scent preparation at all. In another study, one group of worms was exposed to the smell of yet another deadly bacterium, while the other worms were exposed to a benign bacterium. The group exposed to the deadly stench activated twice the number of protective molecules that guard against neuronal damage than the other group. What's cool is that that protective molecular shield appeared to last for nearly a full day after the initial scent exposure. Now, what's interesting about that last study is that the worms exposed to the deadly bacterium appeared to learn the smell and the threat it presented, and then they stored that memory so that it was easy to access later. What's kind of crazy is that researchers actually think the olfactory triggers of the humble roundworm could benefit humans as well. In further studies, researchers want to examine whether humans also have a similar defense mechanism trigger that could boost our own molecular protection for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. This week I learned that stress can be just as harmful to your body as an all-junk food diet. Researchers from Brigham Young University wanted to find out how stress affects the digestive system of mice. They gathered equal numbers of male and female mice and then split them into two groups. One group was fed a high-fat diet for 16 weeks and the other ate a regular healthy diet. Then all of the mice were exposed to mild stress over the course of 18 days. During that time, researchers measured mouse anxiety by how much and where the mice traveled in an open field. Then they dug into the mouse poop, specifically the microorganisms that reflect the digestive and metabolic health of their little subjects. And the researchers found a fascinating difference between the male and female mice. In the high-fat diet group, males had a worse time with stress than the females on the high-fat diet group. They were less active and showed more anxiety than their female counterparts. But what was really interesting was what stress did to the mice in the healthy group. Male mice appeared to have no change in their digestive health due to the stress, but the female mice did. The very composition of the female's gut microorganisms changed to one that would align with a high-fat diet. So even though the mice were eating normally and healthy, it didn't matter. They might as well have eaten all junk food for what stress was doing to their system. And sure, the study was done on animals, but researchers think that the findings point to a possible source of gender discrepancy in the different ways the digestive system responds to stress in males and females. This week I learned that fish get depressed too. In fact, fish wear their depression on their fin. Fish that are feeling bummed swim at the lower half of their tank, and those that aren't depressed tend to swim up at the top of the tank. Scientists at the Troy University in Alabama use something called the novel tank test to examine depression in zebrafish and the effectiveness of antidepressants. And they found that you can also track the severity of a fish's depression this way. Their depression can be measured by how much they spend at the top or bottom of a tank. This is something of a pet project for these Alabama researchers who have been working on it for about 10 years. And one of the issues they debated heavily during that time was what exactly to call this dismal state they found their fish subjects to be in. Was it anxiety? Melancholy? Was depression too serious and big a word for what these little critters were exhibiting? In the end, they decided it couldn't be anything but depression. That's because the zebrafish they were studying exhibited the same symptoms as humans. They weren't just swimming at the bottom of the tank, but they were also slowly losing interest in just about everything from food to toys to exploration. In fact, the scientists are finding that the neurochemistry between depressed fish and depressed humans to be surprisingly similar, which could mean benefits down the road in terms of treating depression in humans. What sets most domestic fish down this dark hole of depression is a lack of stimulation. Fish are a lot smarter and more curious than we humans give them credit for. Studies have shown that fish can use tools and even recognize individual faces. So when a fish is left in a tank with nothing but the reflection of its own forlorn face, well, what does it have to live for? The good news is that you can perk up your pet if you are a fish owner. One recent experiment found that placing fish in a large tank with an extensive landscape of plants and objects to swim through and around decreased the fish's stress and increased brain growth, which just goes to show there's a good life to be had for a goldfish if you just give it a chance. This week I learned that we may not have the Oxford English Dictionary if it weren't for the help of a convicted murderer. William C. Minor was a troubled man. The son of New England missionaries, Minor was born in 1834 on the British colony Ceylon, which is present-day Sri Lanka. His parents sent him to America for school. He studied medicine at Yale before joining the Union Army as a surgeon in 1863. And it was his wartime experience that likely sent him over the edge. Minor was known as a quiet, courteous, and sensitive man. He played the flute and he painted, but the war introduced him to horrors he didn't think possible. And as a surgeon, he was forced to see those effects up close, the mutilations, the full body burns, and much worse. Later, when an Irish soldier tried to desert the ranks, Minor, as a surgeon, was ordered to brand the Irishman on the cheek with the letter D. He did, but he paid terribly in paranoid delusions. As the war went on, his mental health severely declined and became increasingly difficult to hide. Eventually, a judge ordered him to resign his position from the army. Outside the dangers of war, Minor's mind lost all grip on reality. He spent nights in fear, imagining that members of an Irish gang were coming into his home seeking revenge. He'd wake up to find figures literally looming over his bed. He eventually left his home and moved to England to avoid these nightmarish visions, but they only got worse. One February night in 1872, Minor finally acted on his fears. When he saw the shadow of a man in his bedroom one night, he reached for his gun and the man bolted for the door. Minor followed out into the cold, dark night. He looked down the road for his intruder and saw a man walking. He quickly fired his gun and the man fell to the cobblestones in a pool of blood. The man, of course, was not Miner's intruder because there was never any intruder. The man that Miner shot was a night worker at a local brewery. He was a father and a husband, and now he was dead. Miner, who was just 37 at the time, was arrested. A court later found him not guilty on the grounds of insanity. He was sentenced to life in Broadmoor, England's first asylum built specifically for the criminally insane. Now, at this point in the story, you might be wondering where the Oxford English Dictionary comes in. Well, if you're familiar, the OED is no ordinary dictionary. Unlike those that simply define words, the OED provides a record of a word's historical evolution. It does this through a series of quotations from books, newspapers, and magazines that show the word's usage across time. It's a fascinating endeavor that was a feat of etymological strength for its editors. Editors began working on the OED in 1857. They put out a call for volunteers to read books and send in quotations that illuminated the meaning of a word. Any word, really. But the volunteer submissions were a mess, and after 20 years, the project nearly failed under the weight of the disorganized research. Then Sir James Murray rescued the OED from itself. Murray was a Scottish lexicographer and philologist, and he put out a new advertisement for volunteers, but he was more specific in his request. He asked for readers who could pour through the earliest printed books and to send in sentences that illuminate the meaning of rare or colorful words. Meanwhile, in Broadmoor, Miner had been spending much of his 7 years in the asylum purchasing rare and antiquarian books and having them shipped to his cell. And it was in this immersive state of ancient texts that Miner came across Murray's advertisement. In the end, the call for help provided a focus for the now middle-aged man's tormented mind. Unlike other volunteers who mailed in quotations willy-nilly, Miner had a method. He made a word list for each individual book in his extensive library. He'd index the location of nearly every word he saw. Then he'd reach out to the Oxford editors and ask what words they needed help with. And he'd return to his analog search engine and provide. Miner became the OED's go-to resource for the most troublesome words. And for the rest of the 1890s, Miner would send in as many as 20 quotations a day. He always corresponded with an anonymous address, so they didn't know where he was coming from or who he was, really. In 1891, after several correspondents, James Murray finally got the chance to meet Miner in person. He had thought Miner was a medical man of some sort, but he did have his suspicions that perhaps he wasn't well. Murray traveled to Broadmoor and, according to accounts, revealed little surprise that his main contributor was locked forevermore in an asylum. Murray would later write that, quote, "I found him, as far as I could see, as sane as myself." After that, the two men enjoyed a long friendship. Miner continued to contribute to the dictionary, the two sent letters back and forth, and Murray returned to Broadmoor several more times. When the first volume of the OED came out, James Murray added a line of thanks to his friend and greatest contributor. But Miner's mental health continued to decline. The tormented man even cut off his own penis due to the visions of unwanted harassers he was having constantly. Soon, he even stopped contributing to the OED. In 1910, Murray advocated for Miner's release, and after 3 decades at Broadmoor, Miner finally left and returned to America, into the hands of another asylum. After he died in 1920, the 5th volume of the OED was released. On the dedications page was a word of thanks from Murray to his old friend. He wrote, "Second only to the contributions of Dr. Fitzedward Hall in enhancing our illustration of the literary history of individual words, phrases, and constructions, have been those of Dr. W. C. Miner, received week by week for words at which we are actually working." Thank you. For more on William Miner's tormented life and extraordinary contributions to the Oxford English Dictionary, check out the article, The Murderer Who Helped Make the Oxford English Dictionary, by Lucas Riley, on mentalfloss.com. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can visit theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll also find our 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainer series. And if you've come across any scientific tidbits, fascinating studies, or historical revelations that you'd like to share, email me at podcasts@theweek.com. And until next week, I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.